You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Think of those immortals who are known by just one name. Babe, Ted, Christy, Hank, Ernie, Sandy, Whitey, Willie, Mickey, Duke, and Casey. The extraordinary baseball life of Casey Stengel is in the capable hands of New York Yankees historian Marty Appel, who has written the well-received Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character, for Doubleday, and we welcome him back now on Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Great to have you back, Marty. You're our repeating champion, I'd like you to know.
Well, thank you, Ed, and I would put your first name in that group there, too.
So well, that's very nice. Thank you. Why Stengel?
Largely because MLB Network, when they first went on the air and created their Prime 9 superlatives, best baseball movie, best ballpark, they named Casey Stengel as the greatest character in baseball history. He beat Satchel and Dizzy and Yogi and Babe. Well, he beat everybody. He beat 16,000 people. So my editor at Doubleday called me and said, you know, it's been over 30 years since Bob Creamer's biography of Casey Stengel. Why don't you do one? There's a whole new audience for it out there. And that was the genesis.
The subtitle seems to be perfect, Baseball's Greatest Character.
Well, it came from that MLB Network designation. So he really filled that bill from an early age. I mean, he was a character when he was a minor league player in the 19-teens. Right up till he died in 1975. So he really spanned much of the 20th century and left his mark wherever he was.
He was a 19-year-old playing for a team in Kankakee, Illinois. Tell us about that.
Well, he was out of high school. He got signed by his local Kansas City Blues team, and they optioned him out to Kankakee, Illinois. And the Kankakee ballpark was next to an asylum for the insane. So the patients would watch the games from their window, and the local newspapers who covered that league began to call the Kankakee team the lunatics. Things were a little politically different then. So anyway, it was a gift to me as a writer that I could write, Casey started his career as a lunatic.
Yes, and he had a teammate on that team named Joe Gilligan, and you could tell the Joe Gilligan story.
Well, Joe Gilligan just observed one day that one of them will surely not be there next year, and people say, why? He said Casey definitely wouldn't be there next year, and people would say, why? Is he going to the big leagues? And Gilligan would just point to the building next to the ballpark.
He went to dental school. Was that his true intent in his life?
Well, he was serious about it. His parents had instilled in him the belief that you better have a backup career in mind in case baseball doesn't work out. So this was a real oddity. He went to Western Dental College in Kansas City. And he went for not one, not two, but three off-seasons, three semesters worth. And at the end of the third year, he decided dentistry was really not for him because he was left-handed and they didn't make dental equipment for left-handers, leaving me as a writer to ponder what took them 3 years to come to this conclusion. This might have been accomplished on the entrance interview, you think?
You would think. But what's crazy is I remember with my mom, may she rest in peace, getting an autograph from him when I was a kid. And he wrote right-handed, but he batted and threw left-handed. And what gets lost in his life, about his life, Marty, he was a damn good ball player.
He was a good ball player, but before we leave the left-right thing, Mrs. Kennedy, who was his elementary school teacher, all the left-handed kids were forced to write right-handed, and that's why he always signed his name right-handed.
Right. Whitey Ford, the same thing in Catholic school in Queens in New York City.
There you go.
Yeah.
So where were we?
He was a fine ball player.
He was a good ball player. If there were all-star games back then, he would have made two or three all-star teams. He played 14 years. He hit 284 as a left-hand hitting outfielder. He had a good throwing arm. He was a big-chested, strong, muscular guy. And he played for four World Series teams.
And at what point did he decide he wanted to stay in the game? And boy, did he stay in the game for a long time.
Well, his final stop as a major league player was in Boston with the Braves in 1924. The owner of the team, Judge Emil Fuchs, also owned the Worcester, Massachusetts minor league team. And in mid-season, when it looked like Casey was out of gas as a major leaguer, he asked Casey if he would go to Worcester and manage the team there while still continuing to play. And Casey agreed to do it, and that started his managing career.
And he was a player-manager for several years in the minor leagues, but back then there was the first division and second division, and his teams were always in the second division. He didn't have a lot of success.
That set a pattern for him. He was pretty much always in the second division, no matter where he was. I think he won one year in Toledo, won a championship, and in Milwaukee during the war, when Bill Veeck hated the idea that he was managing the team, but he did win the championship. And then in Oakland in the late 40s, which really, he won the Pacific Coast League championship, and that orbited him to the Yankee job.
Go back to Bill Veeck. Explain what you just said about Bill Veeck.
Veeck owned the Milwaukee team. Charlie Grimm was his manager, and Grimm got an opportunity to move up and manage the Cubs. So they needed a manager, and those who were still there running the team reached out for Casey. Veeck was off in World War II, so he was not an owner who was present on the scene. And when he heard they'd hired Casey, he went crazy because he hated Casey Stengel. He thought by that time in Casey's career, having managed for like 20 years, he was just a losing manager. This mattered to Veeck, even though this was the American Association. And he couldn't wait to get rid of Casey when he got out of the war. So even though Casey won the pennant in the American Association with Milwaukee, he was gone as soon as Veeck came back.
And then eventually, as you mentioned, he's at Oakland, which turns out to be the launch pad for going to the major leagues. But my goodness, Marty, he's 59 years old, but I'm sure he had something to prove.
Well, Edna, his wife, wanted him to either stay at Oakland or retire. They lived in Southern California. They were really happy in Oakland. Life was good. They had a lot of money because Casey had invested in oil wells in 1937, and that made him a rich man. He didn't need to come east and go through all that aggravation. But he said to Edna, I've got to prove to myself and to others that with a good team, I can win at the major league level. And you know what? The Yankees were a pretty good team.
I'll say so. But he had never been in the American League.
Never been in the American League. The closest he ever was managing one year the Yankees farm team in Kansas City after Milwaukee. But that was it, one and done, and he was never an American leaguer at all.
So he goes to the New York Yankees in 1949, which is in the sunset years of Joe DiMaggio's fantastic career. But these two guys were not going to have dinner together.
No. And they were going to test each other. And Casey wanted to establish his brand of leadership. On the very first day of spring training, Casey goes into the St. Petersburg clubhouse, gathers all the players around, and reads the spring training rules. You have to wear a tie on road trips. You have to tip the maid $1 a week in the hotel. And you can't go to the dog track at night. Well, anybody who knew Joe DiMaggio back then knew this is what Joe did every night. So this was like the DiMaggio rule. And you know what happened? DiMaggio went to the track anyway. He totally defied the rule. And when Casey was asked about it, Casey said, well, I wasn't there. I have no firsthand knowledge of this, so I have no comment. So Marty, DiMaggio won that round.
Marty Pell is with us. He's written the very well-received Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character, for Doubleday Books. This was the guy who popularized platooning. This was well before the invention of the draft in the mid-60s, of course. The Yankees signed everybody. They had a wealth of talent. There were hundreds of minor leaguers in the Yankees system, and they hoarded that talent. And Casey found a way to at least give some guys some light on the baseball field.
Yeah, Casey is generally credited with popularizing platooning. The thing of it is, they always knew in baseball that there was something going on between righties and lefties and lefties and righties. It's just very few teams ever had the wealth of talent on the bench that Casey Stengel was blessed with, where he could move guys in and out, and you were probably replacing an all-star with an all-star. So with that luxury, he made platooning an art form. Really only Mickey Mantle, who was a switch hitter, and Yogi Berra, who was Yogi Berra, played every day. Otherwise, you'd get Bill Scourin and Joe Collins at first, and Hank Bauer and Gene Woodling in the outfield. Guys constantly in and out. I mean, what a wealth of talent to look at your bench. And there's Gil McDougald and Jerry Coleman sitting on the bench waiting to go in and play the infield if needed.
From 1949 to 1960, they only missed the World Series in 1954 when the Yankees won 103 games and went home. There was no wild card. The Indians had won 111 games and then were shockingly swept by the New York Giants in that World Series, and also 1959 when the Go-Go White Sox won and lost to the Los Angeles Dodgers. But the three World Series that he lost were all in the seventh game. In 55, when Brooklyn finally grabbed the brass ring, in 57 with Milwaukee, and then they gained revenge the following year, down 3-1 to win in 58, and in 1960, of course, on Mazeroski's home run. His success was fantastic, Marty.
I guess if he had a weakness, he wasn't a good seventh game of the World Series manager.
I guess not. Had he won in 1960, do you think with Ralph Houk and the Wings that history would have played out the same way?
It would have been a tougher call for the Yankees, but they wanted to make this move because they didn't want to lose Ralph Houk. I mean, all these years later, it's hard to remember how highly Ralph Houk was regarded, but he was the manager in waiting. And he was considered a managerial genius in waiting. The Yankees did not want to lose him. Detroit and Boston were pursuing him. And Topping and Webb, the Yankee owners, would have said to each other, you know what, we could go another year or two with Casey, but in the process, we're going to lose Ralph Houk. And they didn't want that to happen. And so knowing they would take their lumps in the newspapers, which they did, they fired Casey after the 60 World Series and hired Houk.
And that was a series in which it was considered a misuse of Whitey Ford.
Yeah, in ways that we really haven't ever dug that deeply. But, I mean, Whitey wasn't available for Game 1. He went with Art Dittmar, who was his leading winner that year. Dittmar had won 15. Ford was only 12-10 that year. By Whitey not pitching Game 1, the math would have it that he wasn't available for Game 7. In the meantime, he pitches two shutouts in between, 10-0 and 12-0. Another part of that that's not often explored, which would certainly be more common today, is he wins these 10-0 and 12-0 games. Why was he even in there in the seventh inning? You know, you could have pulled him in the sixth and had him available for Game 7 if needed.
Marty, he became famous for a quote that he had about the key to success with a 25-man roster.
Yeah, he said the key to that success was keeping the five guys who hate you away from the five guys who are undecided.
15 of them don't care.
Right.
Keep the five guys who are undecided away from the five guys who hate you.
Right.
And he also said something memorable upon his firing about how he would never again make the mistake of being 70 years old. And that sounded sad.
Well, it was sad. And, you know, he did look so old. They were calling him old Casey Stengel in the 20s. And that probably didn't play in his favor. I mean, when we think of this bent-over, wrinkled old man managing the Mets in the 60s, it shocks people when I tell them that Terry Collins is the same age today managing the Mets.
Where did he come up with the expression, you could look it up, in relation to what?
I don't think that's ever been tracked, and I didn't see an origin for that one, but he did love to say that when he was making a point. Maury Allen loved Casey Stengel.
He was a writer here in New
York. The late columnist for the New York Post.
Right.
And he even wrote a book about Casey called You Could Look It Up, all about the things that happened to Casey along the way. When Casey died in 1975, and I know we're jumping ahead here, he died on the West Coast near midnight. And I wrote that this was one last favor for Maury Allen because it was too late for the morning papers, but Maury could lead with it in the afternoon New York Post.
He had his own special brand of English, speaking the English language, basically mangling it.
It was called Stengelese. The term became popular when he came to New York to manage the Yankees. It was essentially double talk, and he was very good at it. The players said he never spoke that way in the clubhouse, and, you know, family members don't remember him speaking that way. But with the press, he would use it to avoid answering questions or to stall for time till he thought of an answer. Along the way, somebody told me that Phil Jackson, the great NBA coach, not so great Knicks president, loved Casey Stengel. So I talked to Phil Jackson about Casey, and he said, yeah, there were times after games when I would be double-talking to the writers covering the Bulls or the Lakers, and I'd say to myself, oh, that was just a little Stengelese I threw at them.
And there is black and white grainy footage of Casey Stengel's congressional testimony in the 50s.
Yeah, you should look that up on YouTube, those who are listening. This was the day after the All-Star game, which was in Baltimore, I believe. So it was a convenient time for the Kefauver Commission, which was looking into baseball's exemption from antitrust. I'll let you explain that after our segment is done, Ed.
Thank you.
But
big of you.
Anyway, they called some baseball people to testify on the subject. So Casey was first, and they asked him one question, and he proceeded to tell his life story in Stengelese without pausing for a sip of water, a comma, a semicolon, or a period. And he had everybody in that congressional hearing room doubling up in laughter, especially when Mickey Mantle followed Casey and said, I agree with everything Casey said.
Who called him the old professor?
That was an obscure little thing that I discovered. When he was only a second-year minor league player, a high school classmate of his got the coaching job at Ole Miss for the baseball team, and he invited Casey to come down and be his assistant coach. So at like age 21, Casey's down at Ole Miss as the assistant baseball coach. He couldn't get paid for that, but if he taught a class, he could get a little money. So he did teach a class, which made him a professor, and since he was at Ole Miss, he became the old professor.
Mm. Marty Appel is with us. He's written Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character for Doubleday Books. He's out in October of 1960 after the Yankees have been upset by the Pittsburgh Pirates. Now he's back in Glendale, California with Edna. But he does get offers in 1961, an expansion year.
Yeah, he got an offer from Gene Autry to manage the expansion Los Angeles Angels. And he got an offer from Horace Stoneham up in San Francisco, where he was still a big name from his days in Oakland. And, of course, historically, he had a connection to the Giants, having played for John McGraw in the Polo Grounds. Not that people in San Francisco would have cared that much about it, but he was one of the great names in American sports in 1961. Anyway, he turns both those offers down, spends the year working on his own autobiography with a fellow named Charles Dexter, and then George Weiss, his old boss at the Yankees, moves on to become president of the expansion New York Mets. And he reaches out to his old friend Casey Stengel and says, I need you. I need you to come back to New York and manage this team. So Casey discusses it with Edna. She's totally against it. He's now 72. They're living a great life in this palatial home in Glendale, California. But Casey feels he owes it to George Weiss, who was always there for him all those years. And he also kind of likes the idea of sticking it to the Yankees to go back to New York and compete with the team that fired him, drop media attention away from the Yankees, occupy the back page of the tabloids now and then. So he takes the job.
And wins 40 games and loses 120, the modern record, and yet never knocked his players in public.
He didn't really know them.
Well, speaking of which, there was a time in 62 when the Mets acquired a catcher named Joe Pignatano from the San Francisco Giants. Pignatano had been signed originally by the Brooklyn Dodgers. He grew up in Brooklyn, but it was just his bad luck that by the time he got to the major leagues, the team was in Los Angeles. Yeah. So he is acquired by the New York Mets from the San Francisco Giants, and he told the story that one day Casey Stengel asked for John Blanchard to be the pinch hitter, and Pignatano had to remind Casey he's not on the team. He used to be on your team across the river at Yankee Stadium, not in the Polo Grounds.
And this reminds me of Gene Woodling at the end of his career. He had been on those five straight pennant winners Casey had in the early 50s, and now he's wrapping things up as a member of the 62 Mets, and he's sitting in the dugout one day, and Casey walks by him and winks and says to Woodling, "Ain't like the old days, is it?"
but a brilliant marketing move by the Mets to do this.
Let me tell you something. The Mets got so much right in year one. They seldom get enough credit for this, but here's this organization just starting out. Their mascot, their theme song, their logo, their announcers, the fans bringing banners into the ballpark, and certainly the hiring of Casey Stengel. All brilliant, all in this first year. It was a terrific start for the organization in that sense.
The Yankees discouraged banners, correct?
Placards, Casey would like to call them.
Placards.
The fans with their placards. And the big showdown was the first Mayor's Trophy game at Yankee Stadium, when the Met fans showed up with their placards and the Yankee Stadium ushers tried to confiscate them all because they weren't allowed in Yankee Stadium. So we know how that turned out. Fans are now encouraged to bring banners, and all of New York baseball lightened up after that little confrontation.
The Mayor's Trophy game, a game played for charity each year at one time between the Yankees and the Mets. But Casey also designated responsibilities to his coaches that first year, among whom was Rogers Hornsby.
Hornsby, I think, has the highest lifetime average of any right-hand hitter in baseball history. Wasn't a very good manager, wasn't a very good coach, but he was the hitting coach for the Mets. He spent a lot of that season in their minor leagues working with those hopeless prospects.
Suspects, not prospects.
He died later that year, so that came to an abrupt end. And the Mets pitching coach, Red Kress, also died that year. So, that 40-win season took a lot out of everybody.
I guess so. But the coaches made out the lineup, and then one of the players ran the game on the field.
Exactly. Casey's role as a manager changed dramatically. In that last year with the Yankees, he was Casey Stengel. He was engaged in every pitch. He was thinking 3 and 4 innings ahead. He was on top of everything. By the time he got to the Mets in 62, Solly Hemus and Cookie Lavigetto were making up the lineup, doing the pitching rotation. And Richie Ashburn, the longtime Phillies all-star who is now wrapping things up, playing center field for the Mets, he was running the game on the field. He was positioning the defense. He was making calls on the field. So Casey was snoozing in the dugout. More than one of the players told me that was true. And then at the end of the game, somebody would poke him and wake him up, and he'd go entertain the writers with stories about Babe Herman and the old Giants and the old Dodgers.
but illustrative of just how smart this guy was, always thinking on his feet, here he is on television to give the starting lineup to Lindsey Nelson, the legendary broadcaster for the New York Mets, and he's going to give us the lineup.
And he can't remember the right fielder. So he starts talking in Stengelese about who the right fielder is, and he remembers certain things about him. where he's from. He's got a station wagon. A lot of kids came down from Florida for spring training. And his name rings a bell, and that's it. Gus Bell.
You mentioned a moment ago about the writers. He called them my writers. And my goodness, they said he was legendary with regard to his ability to consume alcohol and still be coherent at 4 a.m. Talk, if you will, about his relationship with the writers.
Well, it worked. I mean, calling them my writers really helped endear them to him. If Nixon had only called Woodward and Bernstein my writers, American history would have been different. But Casey called the sports writers covering the Mets my writers, and they loved everything he had to say, and they hardly paid attention at all to the team losing 120 games. Casey had an expense account in the hotel bars. He'd buy round after round for the writers. He'd drink enormous amounts, but he was really never drunk. It was just a way of getting through the evening and the night, and he regaled them with his stories that went back to, when he was a kid living in Kansas City, his neighbor was Kid Nichols, a 300-game winner from the 19th century. So he could go back and tell them Kid Nichols stories. Let alone John McGraw and Wilbur Robinson.
But he had a great line. If somebody were to ask him, Marty, about Kid Nichols, he would say this. He is still dead at the present time.
That's right. He would say that a lot. Or if he was taking a nap, he might say, tell him I'm being embalmed. Somebody was trying to get him.
At the end of his career, the Mets acquired Warren Spahn from the Milwaukee Braves. And Spahn had a prior life with Casey.
Before Casey went to Oakland, he had managed the Boston Bees in the early 40s. And Warren Spahn was a prospect there, and Casey didn't think he showed him much and didn't pitch inside much, and Casey didn't think he had the guts to be a tough pitcher. So he sent him back to the minor leagues. As we all know, Spahn returned to the majors after Casey was gone. Is he still the winningest left-hander in baseball history?
As far as I know, yes.
So anyway, he became an immortal. And then he goes to the Mets near the end to play for Casey again. And he's no longer Warren Spahn anymore. But he says, I played for Casey before and after he was a genius.
But at that time, Marty, it only took him 3 years. And by 1964, in a new stadium called Shea Stadium, they're outdrawing the Yankees, who would go to the seventh game of the World Series that year.
That was gave great delight to Casey. He wanted to stick it to the Yankees. Of course, the opening of the new stadium on the World's Fairgrounds helped a lot. But it was a tremendous metamorphosis that took place in those few years. New York again returned to its roots, they said, as a National League town. People were largely still going out to see the Dodgers and the Giants when they came back to New York. But ultimately, the Mets themselves and the new stadium became a great drawing card. So in that sense, Casey kind of fulfilled that wish that George Weiss hoped.
And he called them amazing.
Called them amazing, and when they had a press conference to showcase the new Shea Stadium, he wrapped up the press conference by saying, and they got 23 bathrooms here, and I need one right now.
Marty, congratulations on a fabulous book. It's called Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character for Double A, so that'll do it for Marty Appel and myself on MLB.com. If you were on the move, thanks for the ride, and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.